Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Kidney Compass. We're recording a series of special episodes related to the European Renal Association Congress in Glasgow, and I'm really excited today. I'm speaking with Lisa Wilcox, who is a consultant nephrologist at Addenbrooke's Hospital, and Lee, who leads the primary glomerular disease service, also at Addenbrooke's in Cambridge in the United Kingdom. And we're here to talk and hear about from Lisa the results of the Turing trial, which she is presenting, has just presented as a late breaker here in Glasgow. So, Lisa, fantastic that you're here and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me to talk about the trial.
So, Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about why you conducted this trial, the importance of addressing this question, minimal change in FSGS, and how we treat these individuals who relapse or have de novo disease is such a vexing question. But why don't you give a little bit of background about why you did this particular trial?
Thanks very much. So, as you know, minimal change in FSGS are diseases that often relapse. So, when people present with disease, although a lot of them will respond to steroids, many will relapse. So, 60 to 70% of patients will relapse, which means they have another course of treatment. And standard of care at the moment is with prednisolone. A lot of prednisolone. So KDIGO recommends 1 mg/kg of prednisolone up to 80 milligrams. And once patients are in remission, a slow wean over 6 months, which in itself is a high dose of steroids. But then with a relapse, they'll have to go through another course. And so because these diseases are often lifelong, patients are exposed to huge amounts of steroids with lots of side effects. We know in children, rituximab can maintain children with frequently relapsing nephrotic syndrome in remission, but there's very little data in adults. So we did the trial to see if rituximab was also effective in adults and whether we could keep adults with minimal change in FSGS in remission. We included patients with newly presenting disease because of the high risk of relapse even after a first presentation. And we included patients with both minimal change disease and FSGS, as there's even less evidence for FSGS treatment than there is for minimal change disease. We started the trial back in 2019, so we've been going on for quite a long time. We had to stop for a while in COVID, so we're delighted to have finally got to the end of it.
Well, fantastic, and congratulations for completing the trial in challenging circumstances when many research programs were affected by COVID. So this was a UK trial, is that right, Lisa? How many patients did you recruit, and what did you randomize these individuals to?
So we recruited 149 patients, and they were randomized 1-to-1 to either rituximab or placebo. Rituximab was given as 2 1-gram doses between 1 and 3 weeks apart, and it was started within 4 weeks of patients starting steroid treatment for their nephrotic syndrome. And if patients were in remission at 6 months, they had a further dose of either rituximab or placebo. Patients in the placebo group, if they relapsed, were unblinded, and if they'd had placebo, they then started another course of treatment with rituximab. So we've got data from that open label phase as well.
Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about those 140 patients who you recruited over the last few years in this particular trial? What types of patients were they, and what proportion had minimal change versus FSGS? How old were they, and how many had de novo versus relapse disease?
Yeah, so 38% of them had FSGS and the rest had minimal change disease. 33% had minimal change, had de novo disease, and the rest had relapsing. The median age was early 50s, so they were youngish patients. There was, in terms of ethnicity, just over 70% were Caucasian, and the rest were sort of various other ethnicities, which sort of reflects the ethnic mix of UK patients.
Great. And just to clarify, did you include not only patients with de novo disease, but also relapsed disease as well, both cohorts, or just de novo disease?
Both cohorts, yeah, we had roughly a third with de novo disease and 2/3 with relapsing disease, and we had 38% had FSGS and the rest had minimal change disease.
Fantastic. And what was the primary outcome of the trial? And can you walk us through some of the key findings and perhaps some of the additional secondary and exploratory outcomes too?
Yeah, so the primary endpoint was the time from remission to relapse. We had a median follow-up time of 2.8 years, and we found that the placebo group relapsed after a median of less than 6 months, whereas the rituximab group was still, we didn't reach the median remission time during follow-up, so they were still in remission. The median amount, the median patient number of patients was still in remission when we finished follow-up. We had a minimum follow-up time on all patients of 18 months, but we followed patients. We had a final common closeout, so we had follow-up for some patients for 4 or 5 years. So we saw a more than 50% reduction in relapse rate in patients given rituximab compared to placebo. And although we did see some patients that started to relapse a year after they'd finished rituximab, there was a proportion that stayed in remission sort of long term after treatment, suggesting that we were actually modifying the disease process with the rituximab that we were given. We saw a significant effect in both FSGS and minimal change. In the de novo group, we had, because we only had about a third of patients with de novo disease, we didn't, the odds ratios didn't, the confidence interval didn't quite cross zero. So although the odds ratios were similar in the relapsing group, it didn't quite reach statistical significance with the number of patients that we had. About 50% of the placebo group with de novo disease relapsed, just over 50%. And less than half of that, so sort of 22% of the rituximab de novo group relapsed.
Very interesting. So your results were generally consistent across minimal change, FSGS, de novo, relapse disease. And were there any other particular phenotypes that you examined in terms of relapse rates and response to treatment?
We stratified by a third factor, which was prednisolone regime. So we knew going into the trial that not all clinicians in the UK were following the KDIGO regimen for steroid wean, which is a very slow steroid wean over 6 months, which exposes the patients to a lot of steroid. So when clinicians put the patients into the trial, they were able to choose a faster steroid wean. So all patients had 1 mg/kg of prednisolone, capped at 60 milligrams, until they achieved at least a partial remission. But once they'd achieved partial remission, steroids were weaned, either by 5 mg every 2 weeks, or there was a faster taper where the patients dropped from 60 to 30. 30, they had 30 for 2 weeks, 20 for 2 weeks, 10 for 2 weeks, 5 for 2 weeks, and then they stopped, which meant they weaned twice as quickly as in the KDIGO standard wean. So we stratified by that, but the clinicians chose that at the time of randomization. When we compared the results in the two groups, we saw the same effect of rituximab with the same odds ratio in the group that had the faster wean compared to the slower wean.
I think that's a really important aspect of the trial and really actionable information for clinicians, because I know even from my own personal experience, Lisa, we all have some patients who, if they're relapsing, you can get their steroids down very quickly. And to have that kind of data in this trial is very useful in showing the consistency of the rituximab effect, regardless of the steroid weaning plan. So that's great.
I hope it'll also encourage people to attempt to wean steroids more slowly, because that group received about 1 g less steroid overall. So it's a significant effect for the patients in terms of steroid sparing.
Yes, and as you mentioned earlier, considerable, because this all adds up over time in these patients who are often young and have multiple relapses. And although this wasn't addressed in the trial specifically, Lisa, one of the common challenges that we all encounter in practice is what to do with these patients who respond to rituximab. You've given them a 6 month dose, but how long do you think we should be treating these individuals? I've got a couple of patients who I have kept on who have steroid responsive but frequently relapsing mineral change disease who I'm treating with rituximab. But what really is the evidence for how long we should be treating these patients for?
One of the striking things for me was that there were many patients in the trial for whom those three doses of rituximab kept them in remission for longer than I would expect. So for more than 2 years, almost up to 3 years before patients were relapsing. So I'm not sure that redosing every 6 months is necessary for a lot of these patients. So what I've tended to do, following on from my experience in the trial, is to do the 2 grams of rituximab at the start and 1 gram at 6 months, and then see how long before they start to relapse. I haven't had any patients who relapsed within a year of that second dose of rituximab, but I think 12 months after that third rituximab dose is when there is a risk of relapse. So what I've tended to do is, if they have relapsed, then I've started again, but then I've then given them an annual maintenance dose to try to keep them in remission. It would be really great to sort of test that as a hypothesis in terms of whether an annual dose is enough to keep most people in remission. We didn't see any patients who developed hypogammaglobulinemia during the trial. Obviously, going in with nephrotic syndrome, they were almost all hypogamma when we randomized them, but IgG improved during the trial as they went into remission. And I think for most patients, we would be able to use rituximab long term at doses low enough that we won't end up with hypogamma. But yeah, that's an obvious next question is, when should you redose? Can you personalize it to the patient?
Indeed. And as you mentioned, I think one of the really nice aspects of the trial was the open label treatment period for the patients who relapsed in the placebo arm. And you presented some really nice data showing the relapse rates in those individuals compared to those who were treated upfront with rituximab. Can you share with our listeners what those data showed?
Yeah, so it was really interesting actually. So the placebo group that got re-randomized and then received rituximab, the Kaplan-Meier curve almost exactly followed the main phase rituximab group. So yeah, it showed a very consistent effect. So it was great to have that data. And we just the other thing in terms of adverse events is we didn't have many adverse events. The rate of adverse events was very similar in the rituximab group to the placebo group to the open label phase. From a safety point of view, that there was no signal that rituximab increased risk of adverse events over placebo.
And in Cambridge, are you using CD19 levels to guide treatment? Or are you measuring them at all? And how reliable do you think that kind of strategy is? Because I think there's mixed views and data on that.
Yeah, so we didn't do it in the trial, partly because we were limited in terms of the funding that we had, and partly to maintain the blind by not measuring B cells. I think data from other series suggests that it's not hugely helpful in terms of predicting a relapse. So I'm not sure how necessary it is. We also didn't measure anti. We don't have an measures for antinephrin antibodies for our patients. We did have we've got serum for some of them, but we didn't do that consistently for all the patients during the trial. And we started it at a time when before antinephrin antibodies were discovered. But I think a really interesting question will be whether that is useful in predicting relapse as well.
Fantastic. And Lisa, this was an investigator-initiated collaborative study in the UK. It's always great. We love featuring these trials on Kidney Compass because they're often nephrologists doing these answering questions that are important to us and to the community. not necessarily with a lot of funding support. So, can you tell us a little bit about the experience of conducting the trial from when you conceived it, the key lessons you learned, and if you were going to go back and do this all again, would you change anything? And if so, why?
Yeah, so we're enormously grateful to all of the investigators in the trial because there was very little funding available for this. And it was, a huge effort on everyone's part to collect all the data. I think in terms of lessons we've learnt, I think we've collected a lot of data. Whether we needed to collect that much data or not, I'm not sure, but we do have a massive database now. And we would very much welcome collaborations with anyone who has got an interesting question they would like to ask from our database. I think it's great to have these results, as you said, Brendan. Quite a lot of us were using rituximab in this situation before the trial, and not knowing how effective it was. So, we're delighted to have the data, and I think it will definitely change our national guidelines in terms of what we do. I mean, already so many investigators in the UK have been involved in the trial. It's sort of morphing into standard practice now. But rituximab has become so much cheaper than it used to be. Hopefully this is a drug that will be available to people worldwide and will spare the burden of steroids that patients have been exposed to.
Well, I'm so delighted by the results as someone who frequently encounters this problem and uses rituximab like you do, Lisa. So, thank you very much for all of your hard work and all of the collaborators for putting this together. It's a great trial and congratulations on the result.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So that brings us to the end of another episode of Kidney Compass. This is a special series we're doing for ERA in Glasgow. Make sure you check out the HCP Live website for more episodes from the Congress. And wherever you listen to your podcasts, you'll have the episodes also available. So thank you very much. And we look forward to hearing from you and speaking to you soon.